there. This is Julia Kreutz alongside Sho Ali today, who is filling in for Blake Murphy on Jays Talk Plus. Blake had a really long day yesterday, so if you're watching this, Blake Murphy, go back to bed. Sho, how are you doing on this fine morning?
I'm doing great. Always fun filling in for Blake. Always fun when I get to be on the air with you. Yeah, I actually saw Blake last night.
Did you?
He was hanging out right here in this very seat while he was trying to figure out who the Raptors were going to draft. And then, you know, all the hoopla that surrounded Colin Murray Boyle's getting drafted number 9 overall. So, I get it. It was a late night for Blake.
Yeah. He had, I think, 3 shows on the network yesterday.
3?
Because he also did J.D. Bunks' show in the morning. So, you know, pretty well deserved that he would get a few hours off until the Blue Jays play again at 1 p.m. Eastern today. And we'll talk about that. We'll set it up for you. We will also talk about Max Scherzer's return, obviously. But before we do all that, you know, I do want to discuss basketball with you on a day when Blake Murphy is not here.
Wow.
And now I kind of hope that he's watching because we're probably going to botch this. What did you think of Colin's reaction to being drafted? What did you make of that profanity word that was let out there?
You know, I as someone who, and I've always tried my best not to do this on the air, but as someone who is like, you know, cusses here and there, I took it more as it was like a dang, I can't believe that happened.
Yeah.
I don't want to go to Toronto. That's how I interpret it. Maybe that's like a charitable interpretation.
Right.
Now, he did speak to the media, and Blake played these clips on his special edition of the Raptors show yesterday. But I do think that you take what he says to the media with also a grain of salt, because like, what is he going to say? Like, he's not going to go out there and be like,
right.
I really hated it, right? No one in their right mind would ever say that. But I will give him the charitable interpretation of what happened.
Yeah, I agree with you. Listen, emotions are running high, right?
Yeah, right.
I don't think, even if it was something else, there's just so much between what we see and what's going on in a guy's head and what comes out. I agree with you. I'm glad that we're on the same page. We are usually the ones to give people the charitable interpretation
probably
of things.
Right.
We'll see if that's also the case when we discuss Max Scherzer. I don't know where you stand in that outing yesterday. Obviously, you know, it's good that he's back for sure. That was 5 innings there in the pretty heartbreaking walk-off loss in 10 innings with J-Ram coming through for the Cleveland Guardians. But let's break that one down then, and starting with Max Scherzer here. Show. So 5 innings, 6 hits allowed, 3 earned runs, 3 walks, 4 strikeouts. There were some good flashes for sure. Some hard hit contact as well. Overall, you know, are we happy that he's here? He's back, and you know, was able to get through 5 innings, or are we a little concerned with what we saw on the mound?
Yeah, you know what? I think thumbs up for Scherzer. Maybe this thumb, maybe the left thumb for Scherzer. Maybe not 2 thumbs up, maybe just 1, depending on how he's feeling today. Well, I'm sure we'll hear from John Schneider later today. But I think he looked like a guy who hadn't pitched in the major leagues in a few months. You know what I mean? Like, he just looked like a guy who was a little rusty. He talked about it himself post-game, that he felt rusty. I think the words he used was he pitched good, not great, which I think is a fair assessment, right? I mean, 6 hits, 3 earned runs, 3 walks. It's not amazing, certainly, but it's not terrible as well. I mean, 83 pitches, 55 strikes. I also thought, like, to give him a little bit of grace on this, I think that when you have to face, like, the guaranteed top 3 batters you will face, at least in an inning, when you're playing the Guardians, 2 of them being Stephen Kwan and Jose Ramirez, I do think that is tough, right? And he started the game by going, I think it was Stephen Kwan walk, Kyle Manzardo strikeout, and then an RBI single from Jose Ramirez, and then he kind of picked it up a little bit, right? He threw, 19 or 20 pitches in the first inning. I think he threw 6 pitches in the second, right? So I do believe, looked better than I thought he would look ultimately. But again, I think you want to see a little bit more from him going forward. And again, 83 pitches, I think you feel good about that, considering he only threw 75 in his last start in Buffalo. So yeah, I mean, again, 2 of the toughest outs in all of baseball, perhaps, and Kwan and Ramirez being 2 of the top 3 guys. I think that plays a little bit into it. I'll say this though, Jules, and I'm curious where you fall on this. I mean, even if, you know, we're not 100% sold on what you got from Scherzer, but it's something to build on, that you got in back-to-back starts, 5 1/3 from Lauer and 5 from Scherzer, that does actually feel like you've started to see some rotation stability, which I would argue, haven't seen for a good chunk of the entire season, given the injury to Scherzer and some of the instability with Bowden Francis.
Yeah, maybe this will be the first time the Blue Jays can rely, all season really, that the Blue Jays can rely on a five-man rotation.
I mean, you have to see what his thumb looks like today, obviously, right? You can't bake it in, certainly, but I think it's, you feel good about it, I guess.
Yeah, you have to feel good right now. I mean, yeah, and listen, we're gonna talk to Keegan Mathison a little bit later on the show. John Morosi is going to join us as well, and this is something that I would like to discuss with Keegan as well, but the next 48 hours here are very, very important for Scherzer and for the Blue Jays as well, because as, you know, encouraging as this outing was, not perfect by any means, but you mentioned Eric Lauer, the Blue Jays tried to sort of divvy up, put something in the middle of those two guys. There was just no way to do it with the schedule the way that it was. Well, your bullpen is still in a pretty decent place. I wouldn't say it's amazing right now with the way that they've been utilized, and you know, Paxton Schultz couldn't really close things on Tuesday. That would have been, you need to bring in Yariel Rodriguez, who had pitched in 3 days out of four or something like that, three out of five. So obviously give him a day off yesterday. He should probably be back on the mix today. No Spencer Turnbull anymore, who was DFA'd to make room on the 40-man roster for Max Scherzer coming back from the 60-day IL. So you can't really rely on a Turnbull-like guy for length there. But all things considered, I'd say that it could have been worse,
sure,
right? And you take that how you will. But if this sticks a little bit, if Max Scherzer wakes up feeling okay, and if he's ready for his side in 3 days or however many days that is, then you can start really considering this a potential five-man rotation, which, let's be honest, this bullpen also needs pretty desperately right now, Show.
Yeah, and I mean, with Scherzer, I think a lot of the underlying stats, for the most part, in five innings, 83 pitches, looked fine, right? I mean, the velo looked fine, especially on the fastball. All the spin rates in terms of his career statistics, even if you're only narrowing it to like his healthy years, the Mets, and even if you completely ignore his Rangers year,
right,
and you only look at the good Scherzer that you saw before he got traded from the Mets to the Rangers, I think it's a lot of it was pretty comparable, and that was like 2 years ago, essentially, right? So I think you feel pretty good about where he is physically and about how it's not as though there's anything super alarming. To your point about hard hit contact, I think you want to see him limit that to a certain extent, but I don't know. I do think just there's something to be said for getting back into the rhythm of pitching in a major league game. And one other thing he did mention in his post-game availability last night is that, and I think it's the simple truth, is that nothing can really prepare you for pitching in the majors other than pitching in the majors, essentially, right? I mean, he talked about it very, very briefly, but that, you know, I don't think he was saying like in a disrespectful way by any means, but just, this is a guy who's a future Hall of Famer. He's won multiple Cy Youngs. He's won multiple World Series. You know, I think pitching in AAA is not the same, right?
Yeah.
So for a guy who is so used to pitching at a high level in the majors, I got to think that this was effectively his like rehab start, essentially, right?
Yeah. So that's a good way to look at it.
And again, I mean, you don't want rehab starts to be him getting blown up, for example. And again, three earned runs, I think like you take it. It's not ideal, right? And maybe you could have gotten, you wish you'd gotten a quality start, six innings, three earned runs, but I don't know. I think for the first start in many months after him only throwing three innings at the beginning of the year, I view it as a positive, even if going forward, you probably still need the Blue Jays to go out and find some starting pitching on the rental market, likely.
Yeah, it's interesting that, you know, John Schneider mentioned that during the homestand, something along the lines of, you know, for a guy like Max, it is pretty impossible to replicate being on a major league mound. And then he's talking about that as well. He's talking about being rusty. And I'm wondering what you made of, well, first let's talk about the first inning, because that RBI single from Jose Ramirez that, you know, he advances to second on an error. I think it was an Andrés Giménez, of all people, error there. That seemed to lock in Scherzer in a bit of a different way.
Is that when he hit him in the back?
Something like that, yes. And so, I don't know. I thought that was a point where, okay, we're seeing Mad Max, because he was fired up after that. Locked in, finished that inning with not allowing anything else, really. Came back out, got two very quick innings in the second and the third. Didn't throw that many pitches at all. And then the fourth inning comes around, And it was just a weird one. And it started with that Daniel Schneemann walk. He had him 3-2, gets a warning because he came set a bit before Daniel Schneemann was ready, right, and looking at him from the batter's box. Well, the first one is a warning. The second one is a ball in and a full count. Well, you just walked Daniel Schneemann. That was with two outs, I believe. So you really don't. That is not how you want things to go at that point. And I am wondering if, and then obviously two more runs scored after that, right? So I'm wondering if you saw that as part of the rust, because there's no other way to put it other than that seemed to be a mental mistake right there. Does that sort of fall in line with what you saw as well?
Yeah, I think that's something that you probably won't see a lot of going forward. I mean, and again, this is also something he spoke about post-game, but just that the pitch violation, the pitch clock violation with him, like you said, getting set too early before the batter was ready. He said he talked to the umpire after it, after the game, or like after the inning, and there was nothing wrong there, so he wasn't criticizing the umpire. I think he took full responsibility for it. So I think that's part of getting back into the rhythm of the flow of simply just being on the mound, which again in the majors is just different than anything else, even if they do utilize all these different aspects of the game, pitch clock and so on, in the minors as well. And yeah, I mean, he gives up the double to Schneemann. There was a wild pitch, I think, that got Schneemann to third, and then he walks Jones, right? So the violation not helping in the pitch count prior to him getting on base, and then the walk to Jones. And then he gives up the two-run double to Arias, right?
Yeah, I apologize. It was Nolan Jones who was at the plate when the accidental walk.
quote-unquote accidental.
Automatic walk.
and it's fascinating because I do think with Arias, I mean, Arias is a pretty light-hitting shortstop.
Yeah.
And I think that was just a misplaced pitch, right?
That really was a bad
pitch on his end. And he said that as much last night, that it's just maybe, you know, all pitchers want a handful of pitches back probably every game, no matter how well you pitch. So that was probably one of them. It's also probably not an outcome that happens a lot, like Gabriel Arias hitting a two-run double off of a future Hall of Famer.
A 112-mile-an-hour double.
Yeah,
that was just a mistake pitch. It was 94, which is great. Yay, the velo is there, but it was pretty middle at that point.
Yeah, so that's why I think, like, that inning definitely did not make me feel like, oh, he's on the verge of losing it, you know? And again, he came out, he managed to finish the fifth too. He got five full innings in there. So yeah, I think it ultimately, especially after he'd thrown, like 19, 20 pitches in the bottom of the first inning, I kind of thought, gosh, like if he's really struggling to get outs here, like how long could this outing possibly be? Because I was a little concerned about that, because he only got, I mean, only is relative, but 75 pitches, which was good for what, I think 4 1/3 in his last start with the Bisons. And I thought, okay, well, you want at least five innings, I think, from Scherzer. And after 19 pitches, I thought, gosh, I'm not sure how likely it is he's going to get 19 pitches if he's only tabbed for like approximately 80 pitches.
Yep.
And he still got there. So I view that as all extremely positive.
And he could have been in line for the win there. The Blue Jays were leading 4-3. Nick Sandlin comes in the sixth, allows the tying homer. That was also, it seemed to me, just a mistake pitch that a good hitter took advantage of. I don't think we're that concerned about Nick Sandlin. He hasn't really been back all that long, and Blue Jays seem to be kind of easing him into levered situations. That was obviously a big moment. It went down as a blown save because we were at the sixth inning at that point. I don't know. I wasn't too worried about that. Obviously, you add it all up, it was a pretty heartbreaking loss. But, what did you see from Nick Sandlin? Seemed to be pretty locked in after that.
Yeah, you know what? I think I do want to see more from Sandlin before you continue throwing him into leverage. Mm-hmm. I think the only other problem with that is, and again, I think I like to use the circle of trust, and Sandlin probably still battling to get into that circle of trust, if only because he missed such a huge chunk of the season. But I think you just want to see a little bit more from these guys, even though you kind of have no choice if you're John Schneider to go to a lot of these guys in these situations in the middle of the game. Like in theory, Yariel Rodriguez, you know, it's probably a good thing they didn't end up having to use him. Although, you know, you might say, could you have used Yariel in the in extras, for example, right, instead of going to Mason Fluharty. And Fluharty has been tagged a little bit lately. Little as reliable as he's been, and he gave you some pretty good innings last night, but he is also, at the very least in the month of June, he has struggled with the walk rate to a certain extent. So I think I give a lot of these guys some grace, because certainly with Sandlin, the injury, and he's still, I think, working his way back, because he was pretty reliable in a short sample size, small sample size prior to the injury. But the other thing is, so many of them are on pace for like a ludicrous amount of appearances in a single year, which means that, you know, you need them to be a little more reliable, but you need other guys to be reliable. The Jimmy Garcia can't come back fast enough. And it does sound like he is getting into rehab games, so he's probably not that far away from returning. Like, I bet he comes back, I'm guessing, before the All-Star break at this point, which is certainly, unless something happens with his rehab, but that's definitely viewed as a positive. But you kind of need Sandlin to be able to pitch in these middle relief innings, because, I mean, look, if we were talking about the Jays being up 4-3, and we were talking about this in the moment, hindsight not being what it is, and I had said to you, Jules, who would you rather have right now, Nick Sandlin or Chad Green? I think 99% of people would say, yeah, I think I'd take Nick Sandlin.
For sure. I agree with you. It's tough to look at this bullpen. I think sometimes we get a little lost in the moment that we're living. We get a little micro with our analysis. And you are right in that a lot of these guys have been pitching a ton.
A lot.
And it does go back to the fact that this team has not had five healthy certified starters pretty much since the start of the season. And so you have to rely on your bullpen a little bit more. Now, something that Blake and I also kicked around yesterday, the Blue Jays are not the Dodgers, right? They're maybe eighth in bullpen innings pitched, ninth in pitches thrown by relievers and things like that. That would also include a Lauer when he comes in bulk relief, right? Or something along those lines. So it's not very top of the league concerning, but it has been a problem, and it has been a problem that maybe does interfere a little bit with guys' abilities to stay 100%, to stay healthy. We saw Jeff Hoffman's velocity drop pretty significantly after he was used as much as he was in April. Now it seems to be coming back. What did you see from Jeff Hoffman yesterday, and the fact that the Blue Jays made good on their word there, because obviously John Schneider has been pretty adamant about Hoffman being their ninth inning guy? Well, the opportunity was right there, and there was Jeff Hoffman.
Yeah, I mean, John Schneider said it the other day after the tough loss to the White Sox that he wasn't inclined to really change the role. I think he said, we trust the bleep out of Jeff Hoffman, is what he said on the weekend. So he was, like you said, he was true to his word. I admittedly a little worried about what it would look like when Hoffman would come in again in leverage. Just because, again, like to your point, Jules, I think the velo had dipped a little bit. I think the command has not always been there. But I thought, like, you got to see good Hoffman yesterday, right? I mean, if you're going to use the Jekyll and Hyde analogy, I guess the good end of that is the Dr. Jekyll part. So I guess we got to see Dr. Hoffman last night, which is definitely a positive. I am curious going forward. And again, I don't think they're going to change this a lot, but when Jimmy does come back, I am curious if, and it's not necessarily removing Hoffman from the closer role. It's just, if he's pitched 2 days in a row, instead of really pushing it, would you, knowing that you don't have another off day until July 10th, would you consider in a close game, even if Hoffman is available, would you consider going to, maybe not Jimmy Garcia right off the IL, but would you consider going to Yariel Rodriguez? Would Jimmy Garcia get some opportunities there once he's worked back into the mix a little bit? Like, I wonder if they go, it's not quite closer by committee necessarily, but I wonder if they explore that a little bit more until they are 100% sure Hoffman can get like 100% of the save opportunities.
Yeah, even if this is, if you want to frame it as a bit of load management.
Sure.
Because Hoffman has pitched a ton. And if you're seeing sort of the delayed consequences of that, where he is dropping his arm angle, maybe in order to accommodate for the shoulder a bit more, and then that is preventing his pitches from moving in the way that they should, that is preventing the fastball from hitting 97, 98, or whatever it may be, then maybe you do approach those moments as, okay, we are going to give you a breather so that down the line, you know, things can stay more or less consistent, which is really the point here, right? When you talk about adding at the trade deadline, bringing in more reliable relievers to fill in that gap a little bit, it's because right now you only really have, say, three or four guys that you can trust. And when you're playing in close games, which the Blue Jays, it has been definitely less intense in that way in the recent stretch, but there have been a lot of close games. And so I think that's kind of how I see it. Even if you want to just phrase it as load management for Hoffman, you give Jimmy some chances, yeah. You give Yariel, who has looked phenomenal. I know he allowed a homer on Tuesday, but he's looked really, really good and got his first career save a little bit earlier this season. You should be pretty happy with that. Yeah. And the whole point is to get Jeff Hoffman in October at his best. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think so, right? I think I'm not sure that, like, a lot of people are speculating, like, you know, could this be injury related? I don't think so, right? Ultimately, I just think it might just be a mental thing, honestly, because sometimes it just looks like he is not trusting his best pitches,
right?
And that he, like, really, and maybe he feels he needs to throw his third best pitch in order for his best pitches to be more effective, essentially, even though I think we all feel his best pitch is plenty effective as it is.
Like yep.
And again, pitchers need more than one pitch. We know this. This is not a breaking news by any means. But I wonder if it's just a mental thing with him trying to decide how he wants to utilize those pitches. But yeah, I'm with you. I just think going forward, if they give Hoffman, even after what we saw last night, which I generally liked, I do wonder if you want to see him get just a teensy bit of a breather. And I mean, you know, four runs in a game in terms of run support, whether it's in support of Scherzer or of the bullpen, I mean, that's probably enough to help you win a good chunk of games, right? I think like the league average is somewhere between four and five runs in terms of runs scored per game. And I think the higher end of between four and five would get you into the top 10, right? Where the Blue Jays have been hovering since the beginning of May, at the very least, right? So the offense has been coming around, which is, I think, good enough to help you win a lot of games. I know we're going to break in a little bit here, Jules, but I do want to ask you, like, I think for me, if we're going to, like, hyper-focus on results from last night's game, which we do, right? Top of the eighth inning, right? And you got the bases loaded.
Yep.
One out. Game's tied at four at this point. And Ernie Clement strikes out. Alan Roden strikes out. Now, Clement has hit well enough on the whole of the season that I think I would, generally speaking, even though he struck out on four pitches, I generally think I'm willing to, like, overlook is not the right word, but you know, he's hit well enough that I feel like you can trust that result will change, and it largely has, even in a single game this season, right? So I don't have a lot of criticism for Ernie, even though that particular AB was, like, not the greatest AB I've ever seen from Ernie Clement.
That was nasty stuff from
Junis.
Yes. It was so good.
And I mean, Alan Roden, while it was a tougher watch, he had 3-0 in the count, and then called strike out. I will also say from Junis, the 3-1 pitch and the 3-2 pitch were pretty nasty, right? Like, those pitches just kind of clipping the zone. It was tough, right? So Roden, a younger guy who's still adjusting to the major leagues, as much as we've all been impressed by him for in small bursts, right? But I do wonder, do you think Alan Roden stays with the major league ball club when, I don't know, like Jimmy, it could be Jimmy Garcia, it could be Dalton Varsho, if they had to make a move? Do you think that's the move?
I would think that he is firmly in consideration, solely because, if nothing else,
right,
I should say, because this team has a glut of left-handed outfielders.
Nathan Lucas is back. He's healthy.
Nathan Lucas is back, healthy and being intentionally walked, right, to load the bases in that top of the eighth inning. And it's been sort of interesting in a not so good way to see the way that Alan Roden's season has evolved, because he came in looking like an important part of the now as well as the future, right? Lauded out of spring training by reporters, by John Schneider, by Ross Atkins,
right,
and rightfully so. I mean, this is clearly a very intelligent ball player trying to put it all together in the major leagues, but it's not, there's nothing linear, there is nothing guaranteed about that. And yeah, I mean, you look at an at bat like that, I don't know exactly what he could have done differently other than, well, maybe don't swing and miss. Like, if you're going to swing, make contact. But it's that was just some good pitching. At the same time, you probably want a guy in that situation who can give you something, some sort of run-producing moment with the bases loaded. It was funny you said that four runs is probably going to be enough most of the time. Well, when you leave 10 men on base, you go 1-for-10 with runners in scoring position, you don't score with the bases loaded. That was the moment, right? That was the moment to put the game out of reach, and we'd be having a much different conversation than Mason Fluharty allowing that RBI single that won the game for the Guardians in the bottom of the 10th. It's been a bit of a tough go for Mason Fluharty as well. The month of June has been almost as unkind to him as it has been to Kevin Gausman, who goes today to close out the rubber match. That game is at 1:10 p.m. Eastern time, by the way. So we should have lineups soon. We may even get some John Schneider pregame audio to play in the final segment here. And we're going to keep talking about the Blue Jays, keep talking about this team. We're going to talk Max Scherzer with Keegan Mathison coming out of the break, as well as maybe some trade deadline needs and more. John Morosi is also joining us in the second half of the show, and we are hoping to be joined by Abbotsford's own Cade Smith.
That'd be pretty
cool.
Who
is in Cleveland right now,
yeah,
getting ready for the rubber match. So all of that will come as we come back on Jays Talk Plus on Sportsnet 360 and the Sportsnet Radio Network.
Big opinions and in-depth conversations covering the Leafs, Jays, Raptors, and the NFL. The J.D. Bunkus Podcast. Subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. Julia Kreutz and Sho Ali with you as we give Blake Murphy a little bit of a break. Sho, I have been informed that I have a lot of trouble saying Blake Murphy's name on air. So whenever I do
Who says that, though? Blake?
No, it was actually Ryan Favreau who gave me that feedback, which is pretty hilarious, isn't it? I have been practicing at home so that I can properly say that Blake Murphy is not here today.
Okay.
And Sho Ali is filling in right beside me.
My name has less letters in it, Blake, so that works out easier.
Yeah, maybe that's what it is. It's a little bit of my dyslexia coming in. And let's not forget that English isn't my first language. So,
okay.
You know, it's
Portuguese?
Yep, that's right.
All right.
So, sometimes you'll notice it a little bit. One guy who I have no problem saying his name just because feels like I say it every single day multiple times in different tones is Keegan Mathison, who joins us now to talk a little bit about the Blue Jays. Keegs, I know you're not in Cleveland. Obviously, we have our event today, and we'll talk about that in a little bit. But when you're not on the road, when you're at home, and especially in these hot days, how much of your time is spent just fanning Daisy around the apartment because it's too hot?
A lot of it right here. I'm very happy to be in not Cleveland. I mean, God bless the Paris of America in Cleveland, but I'll take the trip off. And also, Blake Murphy, this is more anti-East Coast bias from crooked Toronto media. I can't keep standing for this. But these few days have been largely spent indoors. This is not my type of year, my time of year, sorry. Boston looks like it'll be a little better. But this is the time of year where doing TV appearances outside gets really dangerous for me. There is no level of matte powder makeup that can save me from how poorly I deal with this heat. So I'm in the danger zone right now. Scary.
Well, thankfully, the heat wave seems to be over. I think we're going to be in a better spot for our event today, which is called In Conversation with Julia Kreutz and Keegan Mathison. I'm not too sure. I'm not sure what I'm expected to do. Either
is your name first or is Keegan's name first?
Probably not. I mean, his name is probably first. I know where it is. It's at Another Story Bookshop. I know the time. It starts at 7 p.m. Can you tell us a little bit of what to expect here? Because honestly, I don't know. I don't know what I'm expected to do either.
Well, it's going to be me and Julia's first ever conversation. It's really fresh content here. And I've had a couple of people point out on the website how obvious it is that I wrote both of the bios for Julia and I, because Julia's is this long, glowing, she is the most brilliant woman in Toronto. She writes for here. She hosts this show. And Keegan Matheson covers the Blue Jays for MLB.com. It's been pointed out to me that I didn't give myself much of a bio. But we're going to be at another story bookshop tonight at 7. Julia and I are going to do a chat about the book, the Blue Jays, whatever you want to talk about. We'll do some Q&A too. And then I will sign and sell some books. I think we have a good number of people coming, so I'm looking forward to it. And I'll probably do the old head inside the freezer door for a bit before I go out the door. But it's going to be a good evening. And after the Blue Jays game too, afternoon Jays game. So we will be there in the evening.
We will get the Q&A portion of it started a little bit early, right now, actually. And before we get to Max Scherzer's actual performance in his return last night, we did want to ask you just how important are the next 48 hours or whatever it may be from now until he gets to his side?
Huge. As Max has explained in great detail many times. the time after his recovery is extremely important. And this is what he ran into in spring training when this first came up. And Max is a thumb expert at this point. I know more about the human thumb than I did in March, certainly more than I ever expected to. But the way he has always described it is that the recovery in terms of his strength and the pain tolerance is very important. And that's why he's continued to say that even when he's back in the big leagues, he needs to recover and pitch again, then recover and pitch again. I'm not sure when he will deem himself out of the woods, if ever, but this is a great step at this point. And to do it at, I believe, 83 pitches, his velocity sustaining itself was really encouraging in that regard. But it is still about the bounce back. And he is very insistent, is the word I'll use, that he pitches at 100% with this, because the thumb connected to the wrist, the forearm, the elbow, the shoulder, it all goes up. And he has experienced before how a thumb injury can mess with your shoulder, your triceps, with something else further up the arm. So we'll see. This is still something that's active. It's a strange one to deal with, because it looked like a lot of good news yesterday, and I think it was, but it's still something that is day-to-day being evaluated.
So 5 1/3 from Lauer, 5 innings from Scherzer. I feel like that probably, and again, to your point, Keegan, we got to see more from Scherzer, the bounce back. We got to see a little bit more from Lauer. Lauer, I've been very impressed by if he's been found money. But with 5 1/3 from Lauer and 5 from Scherzer, I feel like that's actually, for the first time maybe all season, has given this team some stability to a certain extent in the rotation. Now, again, I'm not sure you want to rely on Scherzer's thumb being intact as a plan going into the trade deadline, because who knows, frankly, right? I mean, it could be fine for the rest of the season. It could not be. So I got to think Ross Atkins is still going to look at the deadline with an eye towards bolstering the starting rotation to a certain extent. But at least for now, like in the short term, let's say Scherzer's thumb is as well as we think it's going to be. I got to feel like that gives you some stability for the first time all year.
As to, and it needs to be a huge relief for both John Schneider and Pete Walker, who have, I think, done a pretty good job of filling in that spot, managing it, because it's about saving guys and holding a reliever back one day when you want to use them, but you need them 2 days from now to fill that ugly spot all year. We've seen it with Easton Lucas and Paxton Schultz, Spencer Turnbull, a couple I'm forgetting, but it's been a new guy every week. And the act of balancing and juggling that is difficult and shouldn't be necessary, frankly. You should have enough starting rotation depth where you are not shorting your bullpen for a couple of months. Finally, the Blue Jays are back to where they should be at this point. And Eric Lauer has been just incredible. He's been the best story of the season and is a signing, a minor league deal, that I did not give much time or care or words to in spring training whatsoever, because I thought it was just another AAA deal. There's no such thing. These deals can always turn into something that matters. And for my dollar, he's been their most important starter this last month, what he's been able to do. So having that stability not just helps day-to-day winning, it really helps the bullpen. And at this point right now, you're seeing some squeaky wheels in this bullpen. They need quantity. They need to be able to have all 8 available. And if one guy isn't doing well, see ya, have another number 8 available. Earlier, they were stuck with about 6. And that's hard, because when one of 6 is struggling, you're down to 5, you're down to 4. It was getting messy. So this is a really big turn for them. Big shout out to Eric Lauer, though, for his efforts this year. It's been so impressive to me. And having Scherzer back just makes it easier. This is how it's supposed to look.
Keegan, I know you spoke to Lauer recently, and to the extent that you can share a bit of that conversation, it just seems like this is also a smart pitcher, right? Mm-hmm. Someone with high baseball IQ who really needed to go through it a little bit, go through the ringer, if you will, go to Korea, rediscover himself, get healthy, come back here, and now we're kind of seeing it. And then the way that he pitched his last time out was very different from what we have seen repertoire-wise, right, in early starts. What does that tell you about a guy that can just come out and look so different from start to start and still get the results?
I think that self-awareness is the single most underrated talent in baseball, and especially for pitchers. Eric Lauer knows who he is. Maybe in life. I haven't figured it out yet. But Lauer is aware of who he is, and more importantly, he's aware of who he's not. And that comes with being humbled a bit. He's had success in the big leagues. Last year, he was getting hit around in AAA, and he signed in Korea. I spoke to him about that, and he didn't want to do it at first. He was not exactly excited about going to sign in Korea. He came to love the experience, like most big leaguers do when they go over to play in Korea or Japan. It's an incredible market. But at the time, you have to look yourself in the mirror and say, man, like, is this going to work? Was he ever going to get back to the big leagues? And for times, it didn't look like he would. And every single year, there's a new wave of young guys coming in who are not 31 or 32 or 33. I'm really impressed by how he has reflected on that and put it into action. And you saw that with what Julia mentioned in using a different repertoire last time out. He knows what happens when a pitcher with okay stuff keeps doing the same thing. You get rocked. We saw that earlier this year with Easton Lucas. The first couple of times, yeah, you can fool a lineup when they haven't seen you. But if you keep doing the same thing, it goes differently. We're seeing Eric Lauer stay one adjustment ahead of that. And his awareness of what works in his game and what does not is really important. He is intelligent about his own game, and there's just a level of maturity to that. Maturity varies across Major League Baseball. That's how I'll say it. It doesn't matter. Take two 30-year-olds, they could be very different people. But Lauer, I think, has gone through enough stuff that he's matured as a pitcher and knows what he needs to do, knows what he's good at, but knows that even if it's going well, he's not dominating guys with 100 miles an hour or Kevin Gausman's splitter. He knows he needs to stay one adjustment ahead before he gets rocked. That's so important. And I just, again, so impressed by what he's done.
And that kind of takes us back to Max Scherzer. When you talk about maturity, when you talk about staying one step ahead, I mean, we kind of saw the full repertoire from Scherzer yesterday as well. There was some hard hit contact for sure. It was not perfect. It was not clean, but there were flashes of Mad Max a little bit. What did you make of the actual performance, what we saw on the mound from Scherzer yesterday?
Yeah, the stat line was fine. You know, you're looking at five innings, three runs, three walks, six hits. It's okay. Obviously, over the next 15, 16 starts, you want a couple inches better than that. But the velocity and all of the metrics were very encouraging. And looking into even his final inning, there was one pitch in particular that stood out. It was that inside fastball to Santana, I think, at 94, whatever it was. And that's a pitch thrown by a pitcher who's ready, who's healthy. And in Scherzer's minor league starts, it's hard to get adrenaline up in Worcester, Massachusetts, when you are Max Scherzer. It's sorry to all of our listeners in Worcester. But you were seeing his velocity start around 93, dip to 92. That's right on the line of where it's dangerous for Max Scherzer. Every pitcher has their line of where they need to keep velocity above. In this outing, he was comfortably above it. If Scherzer is throwing 93, 94, touching 95, he's fine. Like, he can do this, and that will help his slider play up, which is still a fantastic pitch and was getting lots of swings and misses. The pieces are there. They absolutely are. Now, it's weird, and it feels almost inconsiderate to be preaching urgency this quickly, but there's 3 months left, 15 or 16 starts left. The Jays need his very best right away, and that's exactly how Scherzer would want it, I think, how competitive he is. But the velocities, more than anything else, were really encouraging yesterday. If he had been throwing 92, we're having a way different conversation. But at 94, he can do this, and he is still an effective major league starter.
We were talking earlier as well, Keegan, on the position player side of things about the top of the eighth inning last night, bases loaded, one out, Clement strikes out, Roden strikes out. And I was saying to Jules earlier that, you know, I feel like I've seen enough from Ernie Clement this year where, you know, even if it wasn't the best AB you've ever seen from him, he probably gets a little bit of grace given how well he's played. Alan Roden, I mean, he's had a topsy-turvy year, right? I mean, he was good to start the season. He was making some plays out in left field. You know, he goes down after struggling, comes back up. He has the knee inflammation. He's had a bit of an up-and-down season. And again, I think you do give credit, especially against Jacob Junis, you give some credit to the pitchers, certainly. But I do wonder, with Roden in particular, let's say they got to make a roster move in the not-too-distant future. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's a Dalton Varsho coming back. It kind of sounds like, based on what Schneider said yesterday, that Varsho seemed to have avoided anything major when he had the tight hamstring in his rehab. So that's definitely a positive. Jimmy Garcia is probably not too far away from returning as well. When they make a roster move, do you think Roden is the corresponding move?
Could be at this point. It depends on what they want to do with Jonathan Class A. Right. His ability to play center, it's attractive, but so can Lucas, so can Miles Straw, who the Blue Jays prefer defensively. I might still have Roden above Class A. But with Roden himself, I still think the Blue Jays need to believe in this guy and give him every opportunity, because the player they believed in all spring training and the player that every coach and executive and janitor and cook in that clubhouse told me about is still there. He hasn't gone away. Roden is way too good for AAA. We saw it last time he went down. So he's in that tough middle zone of how do you hit major league pitching? How do you adjust? And what I see now is different player, but very similar to what we saw last year with Addison Barger, where he had a long run of opportunity and didn't do anything with it. The numbers just were not there. Came back this year and he understood what was happening to him, and it was a lot better. Different things were happening there, but I still think there are examples of a player the front office and the coaching staff really believes in. And you've got to trust yourself and bet on yourself in that situation. If you liked the guy, don't let this sample size of MLB results make you second guess yourself. I think the organization really needs to stick behind Alan Roden, because I think there's still a good major league player in there, absolutely. If that has to include another option down, that's fine. It's very early. It's his rookie year. That's no problem. There's going to be opportunities next year and the next. But those, and when you have Clement and Roden up, you got to expect some contact. That's who I would want up in that situation. Outside of Alejandro Kirk, those are two guys with very good plate approaches, and with Clement, an elite contact rate. Sometimes the pitcher just gets you, I guess, in that spot. But, man, that would have been the perfect spot for Roden to have his moment. He feels like he's close to those, but missed it there.
That is exactly what I was thinking as I was watching it, because if looks like a good matchup, it looks like 3-0, you're like, okay, this may be it. This may be that one hit that he's been waiting on that he can build off of, etc. Obviously didn't come. He's in the bottom of this lineup. We know that the bottom of the lineup will always be important, especially as long as Bo Bichette is batting leadoff for this club. But at the same time, we've also spoken, Keegan, about the importance of your star players playing like star players if we want to get to where you want to go. Now, Vladimir Guerrero Jr. launched one yesterday. It was very, very impressive. It seems like the campaign for All-Star Starter is on for Vladdy. But, beyond that, if Vlad can actually get the power going with some consistency here, what does that do for this club? And especially in this stretch, which seems to be a pretty important one for this team.
Yeah, Vladdy needs to steal some games here coming up. What is it right now? 837 OPS. It's pretty good. He's back to kind of just above where he was a couple of years ago. He's a very good player right now. He needs to be a great player, an elite player. And he is one. We all know that. And I think everyone watching lately can see that it's coming for Vladdy. Earlier in the season, I think he was wasting a lot of bullets on slapping the ball the other way really hard. And that's cool. You'll get your singles, you'll get your doubles. I don't think Vladdy was turning on balls enough. And easy to say from, my seat, but I don't think that he was turning on balls and getting into his real strength enough. And what we're seeing lately is a more aggressive, more energized Vladdy, and that's a very scary thing for everybody else. But if he can tap into his power a bit more, that's going to steal a couple of games. That turns a 50-41 record into 51-30. Things flip really quickly when you can steal just a couple along the way, especially if it's against the Yankees, who Vladdy plays against like he seems to hate them, which is a great thing. And that power can change so much. The Jays need that. They need him in those big moments. They need some of those signature moments because this team has won a lot of games without Bichette, without Guerrero, with Anthony Santander. I don't know where he is at this point. And it's really impressive how they've done that. That cannot last forever. The bottom of this lineup is not going to play like this forever. Kirk, Springer, they'll have some cold spells, naturally. The Jays really need the top couple guys to step in on this. Barger's been a big part of that as well, but Bichette and Vladdy, it needs to be about them. Always has been.
Before you go, Keegan, real quick, Kevin Gausman makes another start today, his fifth start in the month of June, and none of his previous four starts this month has he allowed, I guess, less than three earned runs. Seven earned runs the last time, four earned runs the time before, three earned runs in each of the ones before that, dating back to June 1st. So what's the expectation for Gausman today for you?
Man, I think this is a bounce back for him. He's got to do this soon. He's in too many bad counts. That's what John Schneider said last time, and he's right. Gausman's in too many 2-0, 3-1 counts. And when you are when I say one-pitch guy, I don't mean that as a knock, but one trademark pitch guy with that splitter or the fastball high, if the hitter has the advantage, you're kind of toast. Like, that's a really hard thing to do. More than any starter in this rotation, Gausman needs the 1-2 count, the 0-1 count, so badly. And if he gets that, I still think he's an incredible starting pitcher who can pitch game one in a postseason series, who can be the ace of this staff. His stuff has not gone away. His velocity has not evaporated. He's not old. It's just a matter of the counts he is in. I think it's a real simple thing. So if you're watching tonight, I think that's what you got to watch for, avoiding the 1-0, avoiding the 2-0, because he's still Kevin Gausman. Man, I believe in Kevin Gausman every day, but he hasn't been putting himself in good spots, and it's been tough to climb up that hill for him.
I know Sho said that was the last one, but I do have one more for you.
Okay, I'll bill you a bit more.
I did want to ask you about Jeff Hoffman, Keegan. You follow this team more than most, probably more than anybody, and you've seen a lot of Jeff Hoffman innings. You saw him when he was great, you saw him when he wasn't that good, and now it's kind of a weird in-between. When John Schneider says that the confidence is still there and then gives Hoffman the opportunity to actually pitch the ninth in a tie game, what do you make of that? And what do you make of this stretch for Hoffman? It's a little tough to diagnose, it seems.
Man, I kind of like it. If you're going to throw your support behind a guy, give it one more try. And I know that Schneider saying that he was supporting Hoffman was not met with rave reviews. What John Schneider tells me is different than what he tells the clubhouse, I promise you, okay? And it's okay that John Schneider is not going to sit on the podium and roast his closer to me at 10:30 at night. It's all right. But to see him go back to him, it's in the point where I consider it a gamble right now. Not the wrong move, but it's a gamble. If you keep going to that and it screws up, you're losing a gamble at this point. And they don't have a ton of options, but Yariel Rodriguez looks really, really good. And he has closer energy to me. But Hoffman, when he was good in April, was among the best I've ever seen a Blue Jays reliever. Like, he was winning games by himself. Some of those two-inning appearances were amazing. Yeah. But lately, it's the home runs getting him. And it's, again, those little velocity bands needing the harder slider. And sure, some of the home runs have been tough luck, but I cover the score of the game, not the wind patterns and the expected numbers, blah, blah, blah. They have been home runs, and they've been in very bad spots. And when you are a closer, part of the deal you sign is accepting that small sample sizes mean big things. We can be a little reactionary with closers because that's the job. And what we've seen lately from him has not been good, but we know that a great closer is in there. So hopefully for him, yesterday was a bit of a turn in that direction for Hoffman, but he's close. He is close, but he's still fighting out of this. And as John Schneider keeps going back to him, I'll say it again, it's like it's a gamble that he's making, and he's hoping to win.
We'll keep an eye on that. We'll keep an eye on Gausman for sure. I guess I'll see you later in a few hours. That'll be exciting, I guess. I'm looking forward to it. Thank you so
live
much for
person.
Joining. We appreciate
thanks,
you being
guys.
Here, and we'll see you later. Keegan Matheson, MLB.com, joining us from his office. Beautiful office where he keeps all of his baseball cards. That was a fun chat.
I didn't know Keegan was a baseball card guy.
He's a huge baseball card guy. Are you a baseball card guy?
You know what? I was when I was younger. I don't think I've really spent a lot of time trying to collect baseball cards. You know why? Honestly,
what
is like now? If I want a Vladdy rookie card, there's like a billion versions of a Vladdy rookie card. You know what I mean? Like it's like the orange refractor Vladdy rookie card and the platinum refractor diamond, double diamond Vladdy rookie card. And
that's fair.
The purple one. And there's a gold one in there and there's a double gold one. I don't know.
It just creates a necessity over and over again.
Too much.
I understand. Yeah. Listen, we have other hobbies. It's fine. All right. We're going to take a break now. We're going to talk to John Morosi of MLB Network. When we come back, we'll talk around the league, talk a little bit Blue Jays with him as well, maybe touch on some trade deadline stuff, and maybe Cade Smith will join us from Cleveland as well in the second half. We're still waiting on confirmation on that, but all that will be next as Jays Talk Plus continues on Sportsnet 360 and the Sportsnet Radio Network.
Teeing up the biggest games of the night, it's the Fan Pregame with Ailish Forfar and Justin Cuthbert.
Weekdays at 6 p.m. on Sportsnet, Sportsnet 590 The Fan, and wherever you get your podcasts.
JSTOC Plus. I'm Julia Kreutz alongside Sho Ali. That's slacker Blake Murphy taking a day off today, but the show goes on. And now we're going to talk to John Morosi from MLB Network, who joins us from his office apparently as well. That's such a great setup you have there, John. Every time I see it, it's like, oh man, that's what I aspire for as a baseball person.
Julia and Sho, great to be with you. I got to tell you this. This looks pretty good behind me. The rest of the state of my office, it needs a lot of work. This is an ongoing conversation between my wife and I. She basically, her workspace, the entire house, our daughters, it's all immaculate except for the room where I'm sitting. So do not be deceived by what's behind me. My wife was a physician. Like, everything is detailed, scientific, exactly the way that it should be, except for this space. And by the way, I do want to mention this, Julia and Sho. I always love working with both of you. And actually, I was able to listen last night to Sho's work on the pregame show. We actually just got back from Italy yesterday.
Oh, wow.
And landed at Pearson. So I made the drive. So we landed in Toronto. I made the drive home through Windsor last night. So Sho, you and the Jays broadcast brought us home. So awesome. It's great to be with you here this morning.
Yeah, always fun to get to catch up with you, JP. You know, it's funny too. You talk about, the negotiations that go on with your wife. My wife is a lawyer and we share an office as well. So I like to have a lot of Star Wars paraphernalia on my shelves, which she hates. So I totally get it. I 1000% get it.
I appreciate the support, Sho. Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah. The messy part is way, way more relatable, I think, for all of us, which is pretty funny. And John, listen, I know maybe you're not as caught up because you just came back from Italy, as you said.
Right.
But I did want to start by asking you about Jacob deGrom, who kind of surprised us a little bit and carried a no-hit bid through the eighth inning there in the Rangers win over the Orioles. I mean, how much of that were you able to sort of catch it, and what did you make of it?
Well, I it's interesting. I was listening on the dial last night, so I was listening to the Jays a lot, listening to some Tigers, and then I saw the alert, DeGrom had not, at that point in time, allowed a base runner. And so I all of a sudden had to flip over to that game, listening to Jared Sandler call the game on the Rangers radio network. DeGrom is fascinating for a couple different reasons. Number one, it was true long before last night, but we can definitively say now, he is all the way back. All the way back. We did a game on the MLB Network Showcase. It was in, I think, late April, early May in Texas. Astros, Rangers. I think it was May. And DeGrom matched up against Hunter Brown. The whole game, it seemed, took about an hour and 50 minutes. And both of them that night had no-hit stuff. And it was interesting. We had the Mets not long after that, and I was just sharing with some of the people around the Mets, like, listen, I saw Jake pitch in person. He's all the way back right now, and he truly is. And Julia and Sho, the fascinating thing for me will be if DeGrom keeps this going for another couple years, and again, we're talking about start to start here, but if he can stack together two or even three more elite years, what does the Hall of Fame conversation become for him? Because the pure peak dominance, at his absolute peak, it was Pedro Martinez Koufax-esque for like 2 years, maybe three. And so the question is, at what point in time are there enough of the elite of the elite seasons to override the fact that he's missed a lot of time due to injury? And he's already at fairly advanced baseball age. So the chances for him, he's going to have a Randy Johnson-esque final 5 years or so to have a strong Hall of Fame resume. But you start wondering, do we not compare him as much to the aces of bygone eras? Don't even bother comparing him to Bob Gibson, Ferguson Jenkins from a standpoint of innings. Compare him instead to, is he almost a supercharged starting version of Billy Wagner's numbers?
Right.
From a standpoint of Wagner, it's a different role, totally different job. But if you stack up the innings and the ERA and say, wait a minute, if we're letting Wagner in, and by the way, I believe we should, then DeGrom will have more innings, not quite as dominant as Wagner, but kind of close. And that's where the Hall of Fame discussion for this generation of starting pitcher, Julia and Show, becomes really interesting.
I love the Hall of Fame discussions.
Yeah.
Honestly, I do. And John, you know, I do wonder, I mean, I think Clayton Kershaw is not that far away from the 3,000K club. And I mean, he's almost assuredly going to get there because it's like eight strikeouts or something is where he's sitting,
right,
away from that. So I got to think he's going to hit that milestone. But I do wonder, just like going forward, I wonder if we are going to have to, especially for pitchers, reevaluate the milestones that we view. Hey, this is, you hit this benchmark, you're getting into the Hall of Fame, right? Because as we know, pitchers are just, they just don't go as long as they used to. They're probably going to get far fewer strikeouts just career wise. It doesn't necessarily mean that pitchers are worse now necessarily, but they're just used in such different fashions. I wonder if, like, we're not going to be able to use the 500 home run benchmark or the 3,000 strikeout or the innings pitched. You know what I mean? Like, those kinds of previous benchmarks will probably have to be rejigged to a certain extent.
You're exactly right, Sho. And it's interesting, there are certain players that pace out on those old-timey numbers that either had a chance to reach them or actually still have a chance to reach them that you wouldn't think of as Hall of Famers. For example, check out Eugenio Suarez,
sure,
as a third baseman and his pace for home runs. None of us would think about him as a Hall of Famer. He's got an outside shot at 500 home runs. Small, but it's real, because that's a typical Eugenio Suarez year, is like 220 with 30-plus homers.
Right.
You keep doing that long enough, you might eventually have the math work out and get to 500. I think another example on the pitching side of things is CeCe going in this year so obviously and by acclamation without having 300 wins. When was the last time a starting pitcher without a Pedro Martinez-esque ERA got in this clearly on the first ballot without getting 300 wins? And I think this now, again, you're dialing back the benchmark. The benchmark probably to a lot of us becomes 200. And that's right around the range where Adam Wainwright is. I am someone who is a pro Adam Wainwright for the Hall of Fame person, because he got to the 200 win mark. And also you add in the postseason track record. It's fundamentally different. Bob Gibson, there was, for a lot of his career, one round of the playoffs, right? One, there was a World Series. That was it. And pitchers were utilized differently. Now, the postseason is longer. You have more rounds. And so let's maybe bump down the regular season expectations. But then if someone like Wainwright, who was all over October for a decade, you kind of give him credit. Say, listen, that seventh month matters more now because it's a different way of competing. So I give a boost to Adam Wainwright. Certainly Scherzer is a lock. Verlander's a lock. Greinke, not a great October track record necessarily, but he's in that range too. It's just, it's a fun conversation. You're exactly right, Joe. What used to be 300 wins and in, we just don't see those round numbers quite in the same way anymore.
And when we're talking about a pitcher like DeGrom, like you said, he missed a lot of time because of injuries, but I wonder if we also have to include into the conversation the fact that he has made the adjustments and now here he is, and to your point, all the way back.
All the way back. And I think that you're exactly right, Julia, that the context of someone's career is really important. And I'm a big believer, and this is why the Hall of Fame conversations are so much fun to have. We have to consider each player in the context of the era in which they played. Did they help define the era? Or did they stand out in some transformative way? I'm someone who have, in the past, I've supported Mark Burley as a Hall of Famer, in large part because look at what he did all those years in a row. 200 innings, of course. Remember well Gibby trying to get him that 200 inning mark when he was in a Blue Jays uniform and how much that mattered. Well, he was doing that at a time where we started to see the overall durability of pitchers start to dip a little bit. And so I think that's why you have to consider the context. And in the context of Jacob DeGrom's era, much different than Ferguson Jenkins, who had, five seasons of 300 innings. Okay, Ferguson Jenkins. The pride of Chatham, Ontario. Just go back and look at his numbers. And by the way, my favorite Ferguson Jenkins story is during a number of those years, he was spending his winters not at Driveline in Seattle, but playing basketball for the Harlem Globetrotters. By the way, just want to mention that. We talk about what's the key to longevity. Well, if you ask Ferguson Jenkins, he'd tell you you should play hoops in the winter, keep yourself athletically in shape, and then go out and throw 300 innings because that's exactly what he was doing. So we can't grade Jacob DeGrom on Ferguson Jenkins' curve. Grade him against his contemporaries, many of whom have missed time because they're throwing 100 miles an hour and blowing out. Fergie was not throwing 100 miles an hour. It's just a different era, different type of competition. I think you're exactly right, Julia, that in considering the context, if Jacob DeGrom had arm injury and then basically not come back this year, you'd say probably he's going to fall short of the Hall of Fame. But if he's able to come back and have two or three more elite seasons, it starts to change a bit because of the context, Julia, that you're mentioning right now.
So after the win last night, the Rangers, they are 40-41. They've won two in a row. They're still not in a playoff spot. I do wonder, you know, when you look at the playoff race, and again, it's early, so we haven't even gotten to the All-Star break yet. There's a lot of baseball left to be played. So we know this. But, you know, you look at teams that have to turn their fortunes around in order to decide whether or not they are sellers or buyers at the deadline, John. I mean, the Rangers are probably in that middle, I would say. The Red Sox, maybe the Twins, maybe the Royals. All teams that, at least right this second, are not in
that
a playoff spot.
That bubble is still alive and well. We're just waiting for it to disperse a little bit, but so far.
No. And it hasn't, right? And I do wonder, John, I mean, I wonder how much longer we're going to see teams wait before pulling the trigger on making that decision, right? Because, of course, apart from the Tigers, a lot of these teams, including the Yankees and Astros, frankly, are kind of in the same boat record-wise, even if it's just a handful of games ahead. You know, you have the third wild card, which definitely, I think, encourages teams holding on until the last second. But I'm curious, like, you take a lot of a more of a national view around Major League Baseball. When you look at what teams are hoping to accomplish between now and the All-Star break, now and the trade deadline, I wonder what you see when it comes to that American League race.
Yeah, so it's a great question. So I'll tell you what I know first, and then what I think is going on a bit. What I know is that I had a GM text me this morning, who's going back and forth as I'm getting caught up again and getting my brain set on baseball again, as opposed to Serie A soccer over in Italy. But what he told me this morning was, it is as quiet now in late June as I can ever remember it being, from a standpoint of trade talk. Now, set the Devers thing aside. That was such a unique set of circumstances. Yeah. That was a one-of-one unicorn type of a trade. But let's think about that for a second, that a GM said on this day, the 26th of June, that it is quiet. And obviously, you can still see some small movement, but basically that teams are still taking time to discern what they're all about, okay? Where they're at in this. And you referenced the Tigers a moment ago, and I think this is where it becomes interesting. That your willingness to make a big-time trade, I think, is linked very much to what exactly do you think you are in terms of what you're competing for. The Tigers, and again, I follow them closely, I'm here in Michigan, to me, they're a team that should be going for it because I am pretty darn sure they're going to win the division. And I'm pretty darn sure that based on how things are trending, they'll have one of the top two spots in the American League. They're going to get a bye, okay? Of all the teams in baseball right now, I'm probably surest of what their outlook is. Right. And so if that's the case, if you know that you're already into that best of five, then act as if you know that you're winning two series away from making it to the World Series. That's who you are. Whereas basically everybody else, if the race is very tight, and I'm certainly not conceding the American League Central, but that's what I'm looking at right now. You base it on what you think is likely. Even the Dodgers, as great of a team as they are, we can't be sure they're going to win the National League West. There's some really good teams out there. And if all of a sudden, if you're finishing second, then you're bumped into one of those best of three series. And who knows how that's going to play out. So I think it's important to say that you're going to be most aggressive when you are surest that you are going to be in one of those best of five, or that you've got a really good team and you're one player away from separating and getting into the playoffs when it really means a ton for you to do it. And I think that means, when you think about it, a team like the Jays, who I'd still describe as being a very much all-in for this season kind of a team, because Bo's on an expiring contract. You brought in Scherzer, and I thought overall, again, based on what I heard last night, a couple pitches away, maybe a pitch timer violation away from what would have been a different feeling outing for Max. I think that the Jays are one of those teams that will be and should be aggressive. The Mets, they spend all this money on Soto. Just think about it. You can't miss the playoffs. You can't finish second to the Phillies if you're the Mets after investing all this money in Soto. So I think it really does depend. The one name that I have not heard at all, and actually I think it's still pretty quiet on him right now, but I'm going to mention this name, and I think that we as an industry have not talked about him enough this season, is Chris Bubich from the Royals. Look at him. Look at how inexpensive he's going to be next year. And for all that we talked about Tarek Skubal a year ago, Bubich is in the same service time class as him, meaning he's a free agent after 26. And I believe his salary right now is $3 million. He is about as inexpensive of an ace pitcher as you can find. He's going to be an all-star this year, full stop, no doubt. Look at his numbers. He is one of the best 10 pitchers right now in all of Major League Baseball. And the Royals, as you mentioned, Julia, they're kind of right there on the cusp. Like, we don't really know who the Royals are. If they go the wrong direction for the next few weeks, and their offense has been abysmal in a lot of ways, to me, Chris Bubich should be one of those guys that the Royals put a really high price tag on and say, listen, we made the playoffs a year ago. We've already got our franchise player and Bobby Witt Jr. locked up from now until forever. If you got to take a step back to get some bats, if you could trade Chris Bubich and bring back two significant offensive pieces for the future, if I'm the Royals, I would give very serious thought to doing that, as hard of a move as that would be.
Oh, man. We will keep that in mind. I mean, I'll add that name to my list of players to watch here. And we all know that this is the calm before the storm. So before we let you go, let me ask you this. How vital is it to take some time off here, John, before the storm?
Oh, for me? Oh, yeah. I loved it. Italy was great. It is important because All-Star game coming up. Of course, the draft is coming up and the trade deadline. It was a very important reset. I was out. We stayed in the small harbor town of Porto Ercole, which is near Orbetello. It's up on basically on the Tuscan coast. So there was not a whole lot of baseball talk there. I will say this, that the thing I was proudest of is that we rented a car for the week. I drove in Rome,
nice.
Which, talk about courageous acts in my life, driving there. And then I'll leave you with this. We were getting ready to go to the airport yesterday. So I get up in Rome. I'm trying to figure out how to drive and get to the airport. And I start driving down this small, and I'm saying one lane, one way. Like, you barely can even fit a car down there. And I'm looking ahead of me. Oh, no. It's a tomato truck. So, like, there's no escaping this. It's gonna be there forever. So I look around, okay? So I'm like, what am I gonna do? So I throw the car in reverse and start driving for like half a block or more, just backwards down this one little lane. And I got people on either side of me, Vespas everywhere. Here's this American. And I look to my left, and again in Rome, like, my nose to the nose of the Vespa next to me is about this far away. Like, I'm holding, like, probably 4 inches. And this guy looks at me, shakes his head. Tu sei morto incapacitato. Basically, you're incompetent. I mean, that, like, what is this American? Tu sei molto capacitato. I just, hey, mano. I just said, I got to go. I threw it back. I was inching back about an inch every minute, and somehow I'm here talking to you. So I said a prayer. I got here, and grateful for the trip.
We are so glad that you made it out of that. And back on to JSOC Plus. Thank you so much for joining us, John. Appreciate
it. Buongiorno, piacere mio. Thank you so much. Talk to you soon.
Wow. John Morosi breaking out the Italian. You can catch his stuff, of course, on MLB Network.
I've driven in Rome once.
Did you?
I'll tell you,
how
Jules.
Was it?
Like, he's not exaggerating when, especially if you're driving like from like the outskirts into the city itself. It's crazy. Like, I've driven in Manhattan. I've driven in Rome. Obviously, downtown Toronto. Downtown Toronto traffic actually is like not too terrible, frankly.
Yeah.
It's actually like the surrounding highways that's really bad, like Gardiner and the DVP. But in the actual city core, Rome and Manhattan, wild.
It does put things in perspective a little bit when you get out of Toronto and drive in other places. And then you're like, you know what? Toronto isn't that bad. We can figure this out. Everyone is so nice.
The 401, that's a different story. But the actual downtown driving, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, listen, this is what we signed up for. That's how I'll say that. Show, we do have lineups.
Yes.
To get to before the break. And exciting news, we have confirmation. Cade Smith is joining us indeed in the final segment of the show. So that's very much something to look forward to. Let's run through the lineups really quickly before we take a break and go through that. So Bo Bichette is batting leadoff as usual. DH day for Bo in this final game. Day game after a night game. We're not going to see Alejandro Kirk either. Tyler Heineman is catching today. He's batting eighth. And then some other notable differences here. I would say Nathan Lucas staying in the number two spot. And Addison Barger is back in the lineup, batting cleanup. What do you make of this little shakeup? I guess it does make sense without an Alejandro Kirk there to bat cleanup, but no George Springer today either. So yeah, I guess the next logical option would be Barger in that spot.
Yeah, Bichette, Lucas, Vladdy, Barger, Clement, Jimenez, Clase, Heineman, Straw. And that essentially means you got righty, lefty, righty, lefty, right? So, and Bibee's on the mound today, Tanner Bibee for the Guardians. So who's a righty. So that you can get two left-handed bats into your top four, and you got Ernie Clement batting a little lower down. Probably makes sense to bat him higher than Jimenez if there's no Kirk, and you having and the way you're rejigging the outfield. And the outfield being a little bit in flux right now without either Santander or Varsho means you have to try as many combinations as possible. And on a day you're not going to play Springer, it does essentially mean that, you know, you need to have Clement, I think, batting a little bit higher, even if his OPS against righties is like less than like half that it is against lefties. But I still think you take his bat just as consistent as it's been over Jimenez's bat and probably Class A, Heineman, and Straw as well. Even though I think you've gotten some pretty good production out of, like, offensively out of Class A, Heineman, and Straw in terms of bottom of the order production, I do still think you'd prefer to have them in the lower third, like 7, 8, 9 for those three in particular. So yeah, I don't mind the construction. I think to your point, day game after a night game, meaning you're not going to have Kirk in there. That's something this team, and frankly, a lot of teams do pretty frequently. So I got to imagine it's just a way to keep Kirk a little bit fresher. And if there's a pinch hit situation late in this game, Kirk is probably going to come in anyways. So I don't mind the construction here. Lucas, I think in his lone stint in the second spot a couple of days ago, played pretty well. Yeah, I think he had, what, two hits, including an RBI. So yeah, I think you'll take that, even if, I mean, let's face it, Tanner Bibee is a tough out anyways.
Yeah, that will be as interesting a rubber match as we have had all season.
Pretty
I
good pitching
say.
Matchup on paper, at least, right? Gosman-Bibee?
It's Gosman versus Bibee. That is, again, at 1:10 p.m. Eastern, a little day game for you. And the Blue Jays are back in action tomorrow against the Red Sox. So, it does sort of make sense to give Springer the day off, and I'm imagining that he would be available off the bench. John Schneider spoke to media about 10 minutes ago, so he should probably get some tweets about that soon as well. This is a pretty interesting composition in the sense that it is very righty-lefty. That is the sort of makeup that we have here. And then you have two switch hitters in Jonathan Clase and Tyler Heineman. I will say it's so much easier to give Alejandro Kirk a day off still because of the way that Tyler Heineman continues to perform, show. I mean, you have to feel really, really good about your backup catcher situation when, you know, he's hitting everything and actually putting the ball in play and getting perhaps a tad lucky still with the batting average with balls in play. But it's been really impressive, and it continues to be impressive. We're almost at the All-Star break, and we're still talking about Tyler Heineman this way.
Yeah, Heineman, I think, you know, people were asking last night, because he came in for a little cameo towards the end of last night's game, and we did see him bat. And, you know, we're talking about, like, bunting with him and so on. And, I mean, the guy's hitting. And I do think, to your point, there's, like, a little bit of a luck element in terms of, you know, you look at his BABIP and you look at, like, just the outcome of a lot of these appearances, these ABs, where, you know, balls are clanking off gloves in the outfield or they're landing an inch inside the line, right? And, again, I'm not saying that's, like, bad by any means. It's just there is a little bit of luck. There'll probably be some regression there on the whole of the season. But, I mean, he's also batting, like, above 420 with runners in scoring, with runners on, I should say, right? So, yeah, I think it's like, I think even if there is a luck element for Heineman, and I know people hate this thing, this aspect of it, but you know, you talk about bat speed and exit velo for Tyler Heineman. And while I do think there has to be results consistently attached to those like nuggets of information for it to like actually mean something, I do think with Heineman, I mean, it's like two of the three hardest hit balls of his entire career have come this season. So for me, I do view it as he's doing something like he's made a change that has helped him this year going forward, which I think has got to be viewed as a positive, given that, I mean, I'm not sure, like, I think Kirk is on pace to catch like almost 120 games this season, and that's a lot. Yes. I mean, that's just
easily the largest load of his career
by far, right? And I mean, catchers who catch that much, I don't think there's like as high an expectation for you to also be defensively elite and for you to also be a very good offensive performer. And Kirk has been all of those things so far. Good game caller as well. He has done all of these things while also staying healthy. So I think that you can give him a bit of a blow and get positive results. Again, your expectations are a lot lower for your backup catcher than you are for your starting catcher, but that you can do that is definitely a positive and is somewhat of a luxury, I would say, for the Blue Jays.
On the other side of this matchup, Kevin Gausman, who has not had a good month of June, has two righties that he is going to face on the Guardians lineup. That should be another tough one. The Guardians going with Steven Kwan, Kyle Manzardo, who's also a lefty, Jose Ramirez, and Carlos Santana, both switch hitters.
Right.
And then you have Lane Thomas, who has killed the Blue Jays this series so far. Daniel Schneeman comes back in there. He's also a lefty. Bo Naylor is catching, also a lefty. Gabriel Arias, the second righty in this lineup. And then Martinez is a switch hitter playing center field today. So this is going to be another tough matchup for Kevin Gausman. And as he tries to get right, you look at this lineup, the Guardians certainly are not making it easy on him, Joe.
No, and I mean, look at his outing the last time out, right? I mean, he was playing against the Diamondbacks. It was a 9-5 loss, 4-3. He allowed 7 earned runs. And I think some of those were after he left the ballgame, to be fair. But still, I mean, there were a lot of traffic, a lot of runs, generally speaking. In the loss in Philadelphia, he only went, quote unquote, only went 5 innings. And again, I think that outing in Philly was actually something he somewhat salvaged, right? Because he had a bit of a blip in, I think it was the bottom of the second inning. Right. And then he kind of bounced back for the rest of those 5 innings, which is definitely a positive given where the bullpen was and where the starting rotation was, generally speaking, at that time when they got swept in Philly. But I mean, we mentioned this to Keegan, right? I mean, 4 2/3 the beginning of June against the A's. They did win that game, but even in Minneapolis, he allowed 3 earned runs in 6 innings, which I think you take a quality start, certainly. But I do think we've seen in the last 4 starts, 3 of them have been all right to bad, essentially, mm-hmm. right? Yeah. Which I think you can say, given that Kevin Gausman, like the expectations and I think the standard that he himself has set as a Blue Jay are pretty high, right? And I think you're used to viewing Gausman as being cast as an ace. And I don't mean to be harsh, but I do think Gausman is likely at a stage of his career where he's probably not an ace anymore, right? And I don't think that necessarily means it's the flip side of that he is, you can't roster him or you can't pitch him. He is still a very, very good pitcher, and I think on most nights he has the ability to figure it out because he's that kind of pitcher. It's just, you know, you get a little older, he's still trying to figure out how, on a consistent basis at the very least, how the velo with the fastball helps him use that splitter And I'm sure we're going to see him do that today. But like you said, it's a tall order against a lot of switch hitters, a lot of lefties. I think we're also maybe at a point where the Blue Jays just have a lot of 2-3 pitchers versus an ace followed by a 2 and a 3 pitcher, if that makes sense.
It does. It's a good point. I mean, you know, Gausman has been vocal about him not really being the guy to try new things or to get out of his game plan too much, because the game plan has worked for a very long time. And when you run into stretches like this where maybe the fastball velo is not all the way there, and so you can't really set up the splitter in the way that you would like, that's going to make for a tough one, because you can't really rely on that slider really all that much, right? It's been an okay pitch. It's more of a show-me pitch. It's more just something that he'll throw to put something else in a guy's head so that he can go back to the game plan. Same went with for the sinker, right? When he kind of brought that back last year as he was trying to figure out some stuff. But yeah, I mean, it does, to me, it starts with the fastball velocity. Can he locate it in the zone, but in, you know, high in the zone, so that the splitter can play a little bit better? Is the splitter carrying the zone a bit more, which is something that he has also spoken about pretty extensively? Thing is, the splitter has looked good, right? And if you can get the fastball back to where it was at the beginning of the season, it's tough because you don't know if that is actually going to happen, if we are going to see Kevin Gausman have everything click at once for him. But it's been a tale of two pitches this season where the splitter was not breaking in the way that it should early on. Well, the fastball looked amazing, and that is how the Blue Jays were winning games when Kevin Gausman was on the mound. And then here it is. The splitter is back. It's actually breaking vertically exactly in the way that he wants. It doesn't have as much of the horizontal movement that was something that he was trying to get away from. And now the fastball has regressed, and there's not as much velo there. He is having some trouble locating it in the zone in the way that he wants to, and it's leading to some difficulty in June. Good news is that there have been flashes, and you kind of expect Gausman to be a talented and smart enough pitcher to somewhat figure it out here.
I do still think, even though, and we heaped some praise on Lauer and Scherzer today, right? 5 1/3 from Lauer, 5 from Scherzer in these first couple games. While that is absolutely positive, I do think with no days off for not going into next week, but the following week, July 10th, I believe, is the next time they have a day off, because you got this 3-game series in Boston, I think, coming up starting tomorrow against the Red Sox. You got 4 at home over the Canada Day holiday against the Yankees. You're going to welcome in the Angels as well, and then you're still going until the 10th, essentially, with another series. So I think, like, with that in the back of your mind, you do, I think, at the very least, need a little bit of length from Gausman today,
yeah,
right? Like, you can't, I don't think you can really afford 4 1/3, 4 2/3 from Gausman today. Like, you kind of need something closer to 6 innings and a quality start from him, knowing that, and again, like, I think you can feel good, generally speaking, about Bassett and Berríos against the Red Sox, right? And that's definitely how you want that to line up against the division rival that is hot on your heels, even though I believe they did lose last night, the Red Sox. But you do need, even if Scherzer and Lauer have looked better, you don't want to rely on the bullpen too much today, because you're going to have to rely on the bullpen a lot between now and July 10th, essentially.
Yeah. Once again, we're here asking a lot of the big three out of this rotation. That is probably going to be the case from now until the end of the season, no matter how many acquisitions the Blue Jays make. Let's keep talking after the break, show, just about this stretch for the Blue Jays. I am curious to hear from you just how much stock you're putting into this moment, because this is an important game, right? Stealing a series from a potential wild card opponent. Red Sox series coming up in Boston, same thing. So we'll talk a little bit about that when we come back from the break. And we're also going to talk to Cade Smith, reliever for the Cleveland Guardians, Abbotsford, BC native. He will join us in the final segment. All of that is next then, as Jays Talk Plus continues on Sportsnet 360 and the Sportsnet Radio Network.
Unrivaled insight, analysis, and opinions on all things Blue Jays. Blair and Barker. Be sure to subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. Julia Kreutz and Sho Ali here with you for another 20-25 minutes or so. We are going to be joined by Kate Smith, Guardians reliever and Abbotsford native, just in just a little bit. But before we do show, actually, no. Cade's ready for us.
Ooh, okay.
Oh, this is great. All right. So let's go down to Cleveland to talk to Cade Smith. Cade, thank you so much for joining. How are things going for you over there this year?
Good morning, guys. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Listen, it's been, a year and a half now in Cleveland for you. How comfortable do you feel in the city? How comfortable do you feel in the clubhouse? And just how much are you enjoying your time there?
Oh, I'm loving it. I mean, the atmosphere here is phenomenal. The clubhouse is gorgeous, and to be able to play in the city in front of these fans is so much fun every day. It's a blessing to come to the ballpark, and I know that we look forward to coming home from road trips every time we leave. So it's been great here, and summer's also here now, so it's nice and warm, so it's beautiful.
I love this background, by the way. I feel like we've announced you as our draft pick, which is great. So I love the press conference background. Cade, I've always wanted to ask this to an elite pitcher, an elite reliever, and all pitchers, I think, say this, right? Starters or relievers talk about only focusing on the next batter, right? Or even the next pitch. You throw a ball, can't worry about that. Time to focus on the next pitch, the being placed exactly where you want it. That's your job, and you've done it exceptionally well. But I'm just curious, like, is that mindset difficult to maintain every time you go out? Like, how do you manage that?
Yeah, I think it's a little bit of a strange mindset because, you know, you're trying to focus on really only what you can control. And the part that becomes strange about it is realizing how small that circle really is. So as far as like being in a game, like it comes down to pitch by pitch. It's when you're making the first pitch in that bat, you're not worrying about the second pitch. You're not worrying about the outcome. You have to focus on that pitch itself and executing it. And if you don't, you have to forget about it and approach the next pitch. And that's how you have to handle each pitch, each batter, each outing. That's the way you have to take it. One small step at a time and really taking care of the things that you can control.
You did get some chances to pitch in some save opportunities earlier this year when Emmanuel Clase was injured. I mean, that was around mid-April, I want to say. Three saves on the year for you. Does that mentality, just because we're talking about mentality and what you have to do when you're on the mound, does that change when you're pitching in different roles as opposed to pitching in the eighth inning versus getting the chance to lock down games in the ninth? Does that change for you?
No, I don't think so. I think that, you know, there's for sure an awareness and understanding of the situation and the circumstances, right? Like pitching in a game where it's tied or where you have a lead or where you have a large lead, like there's understanding that there's a difference in context, but my mindset doesn't change. Like I'm going out there to compete the way I can, to focus on things that I can control and try and do those with excellence and understanding that each day I'm preparing to go out and take advantage of those opportunities that I have, regardless of what the situation is. So time of the game that I pitch doesn't matter. I mean, anytime the phone rings, they call my name, I'm going to go out and compete with everything I have to try and, either keep the game close or keep the game tight or keep the game, keep our team in it. Just whatever I can do to help the team, that's what's asked of me, and that's what I want to go out and do.
Cade, I was in the Guardians clubhouse actually covering for MLB.com here in Toronto when you guys were here. And it seemed like a pretty good environment. Guys are just chilling, really, and gelling, if you will. And I'm wondering how much you can rely on your teammates, especially in the bullpen, as you go through a long season with different roles, with ups and downs, and everything that really comes with a major league year. What is that relationship like for you?
You know, I think it becomes an interdependence, right? I don't think that you can get through a whole season without relying on one another. There's going to be days when I struggle and I'm going to need someone to come and pick me up. I'm going to want them to come and do the job. And there's going to be days when other guys are going to struggle and it might be my name that's called to come pick them up. And I'm going to go in there with everything I have, trying to help my teammate out. And also all those other things I've discussed about keeping the team in a spot to win. But really, I mean, it's a long season. It's a grueling season. I mean, there's long days, lots of travel, all that stuff plays a part in it. But to be able to be down there with that group of guys, knowing that these are the seven guys with me who were ready to take on any challenge that is asked of us, any situation, is a huge honor. And I think that kind of mentality it extends to the clubhouse in general, that like the guys that are in that clubhouse are united with the goal that we're going out to play our style of baseball and compete in any way that we can and to play hard and to be resilient and persistent and trust that that's going to help us have the outcome that we desire.
Was it is it cool to also be able to just catch up with or see some old teammates in Andrés Giménez, Nick Sandlin, who was your bullpen buddy last year?
For sure. I mean, you know, they say that baseball is a small world, and I think just even being now just over a year, it gets smaller and smaller as you go on. So,
what's your relationship like, Cade, with Bo Naylor? I only ask because it's not that often we get to discuss an all-Canadian battery, but so what's that like for you?
It's awesome. I mean, he does a great job. He puts in a ton of work off the field as far as the scouting, the preparation, knowing the hitters, and then also understanding how each individual pitcher in the bullpen and on the rotation is going to overlap their strengths against the hitters. So, I mean, he's a great guy to have in the clubhouse too. Like, he brings a lot of good fun to the atmosphere, and having him behind the dish is awesome. I mean, all our catchers do a phenomenal job with the pitch calling and the homework. So, as far as, you know, that battery is a special relationship. Having trust in that is a very, very important thing, and that's definitely something that we have here.
It's kind of cool as well that you guys are literally representing opposite ends of the country when you're pitching and catching together. And listen, I know you guys lost a Canadian, Josh Naylor, over the offseason, but you all got to play together, and you got to play with even more Canadian major leaguers in the World Baseball Classic. I'm wondering just how fondly you remember that experience, and if there's anything that stands out to you from those moments in the WBC.
Yeah, that was a phenomenal experience. I mean, that was definitely by far at that point, that was the most intense atmosphere I'd ever played in, you know, playing in those stadium with that kind of crowd and for something that's so meaningful. So to be able to, you know, understand that now I'm able to pitch in that environment and to be comfortable and to compete and be excited and have fun with it is a huge confidence boost, you know, going forward to pitch in environments like last October. But as far as, you know, being able to talk to those guys who have been there for multiple WBCs and multiple years in the major leagues and to just pick their brain and ask them questions and try and learn from them was a huge benefit too, because they have so much experience and they were willing to share that very openly with me. And so that I could, you know, try and learn and incorporate some things that might help me as I started my career.
You know, I remember when Josh Naylor was still a Guardian and you guys had come here to Toronto, and we had the opportunity to see Josh win the Tip O'Neill Award, and he was handed it here in Toronto, which was really cool. And Bo Naylor was present. Their family was present. That was pretty neat. I remember I asked Josh Naylor then, Cade, if there was any Canadian ball players he grew up watching. And I think one of the guys he went out of his way to mention, as you might not be surprised to hear, was Joey Votto. And that was pretty cool, of course. And I'm just curious. I mean, I'm sure it's different for a pitcher versus a position player. So I wanted to ask you, since we don't get the chance to speak with you too often, are there Canadian ballplayers that you grew up watching? Like, for me, it was, you know, like Larry Walker and Ryan Dempster, for example. But I'm curious if it's different for you.
I think it might be slightly different. So my dad grew up just outside Toronto, so we always had the Jays on at home.
Right.
And so he would tell me more, you know, to watch Roy Halladay and just watch him pitch. So, I mean, a lot of good memories from watching, you know, the Jays. I mean, they'd always be on at home. But yeah.
Yeah, it's an interesting thing to sort of represent an entire country, right, Kate? And I know that this is it's changing a little bit because there are more and more Canadians in the majors, but it's a cool responsibility as well, I'm sure. And I'm wondering if you feel like that as well, and if you have given any thought to the upcoming WBC. Apologies if I've missed anything here, but where do you stand on the possibility of playing for Canada again?
Yeah, I mean, I had a ton of fun last time, and I would love to do it again. Obviously, a lot of things have to happen. Like, first and foremost, you got to stay healthy. Every time we go out there and pitch, there's a chance that something could go wrong. And so that's outside of my control, and I got to take it one day at a time to get there. But I've got great memories of the last WBC, and I'd love to be part of that again.
And listen, let's switch sports a little bit. I know Sho had a tongue-in-cheek hockey question for you. Let's just start with, are you a hockey fan? Did you grow up watching Canada sport?
I never grew up watching hockey. I didn't play it. So
that's fair.
Maybe I'm the atypical Canadian now.
Okay. Sounds like you picked the right path here, though.
I think you did.
Well, in that case, let me ask you this, just to wrap this up here. From the other side, for sure, and keeping in mind that you are very focused on your task and what you have to do, but can you find appreciation for watching a guy like Max Scherzer, a future Hall of Fame, come back and pitch for the Blue Jays?
Of course. I mean, seeing any of the guys who have been in the league for that long is impressive to watch. I mean, it's you know, he's the kind of name too where it's like you grew up hearing about him and watching him, and he's been in the league long enough to get to that point that, like, to be able to actually be on the same field as him is something that's pretty cool.
All right. Well, we hope to get to see you pitch today. We'll see how that goes. It's a little bit later at 1:10 p.m. Eastern. Cades, thank you so much for joining, and good luck the rest of the way.
See you, Cade.
Thank you for having me.
There he goes, Cade Smith. Guardians reliever, Abbotsford, BC native, noted not hockey
not
fan.
Not a hockey fan. All right, good to know. Good to know. I was going to ask him if the Abbotsford Canucks Calder Cup win registered at all, but I'm going to guess it probably did not.
Yeah, maybe he doesn't know any of those words.
Yeah, it's probably right.
Well, I mean, he's pretty locked in, right?
He is genuinely one of the game's elite relievers.
Yeah,
he really is. Like, he is. If you look, Jules, at Cade Smith's ability to keep the ball in the ballpark, there are few relievers, period. Like, in all of baseball, not just in the American, like, not just in the division, not just on the Guardians, not just in the American League, in all of baseball, that keep the ball in the ballpark at the rate that Cade does. So I think that's incredible. I mean, you know, if we had more time, I'd want to get into some of his pitch mix stuff, but the four-seam fastball, the splitter, and the sweeper, which I think has come a long way, look phenomenal, right? And again, I mean, you and I have spoken to Pitching Ninja a couple of times on JStock Plus when I filled in for Blake before. And I remember, you know, you see all sorts of the fun overlays he does when you see the release point from pitchers' hands and the balls out of their hands traveling to the mound. And the release point, if you ever see a Pitching Ninja overlay on Cade Smith four-seam fastballs and splitters, it is the exact same. It is incredible. He is truly one of the game's elite pitchers.
Yeah, it has been. And you're right. I mean, he's allowed one home run in his entire career, which spans a season and a half now. It's been extremely impressive to watch. And it is really nice to talk to a guy who does feel that appreciation, who does feel that pride in playing for Canada and saying, yeah, I'd love to play again. That those are some good memories. And I mean, the WBC, I was so happy when it came back because it is such a cool opportunity for these guys to show their flair, to show their pride, and to play with their fellow countrymen. I mean, I think baseball only has to gain, right, from when all of these stars are together.
Yeah, we're less than a year away from the next WBC. It's going to go or mid-March, I believe. I don't exactly remember the exact date, but March 2026 is going to go, which is, I think, will obviously, like, be in lieu of some spring training games, which I think is the right move, right? You want to have both. But I'll be fascinated to see, like, in the lead-up to the WBC, I'll be fascinated to see. Certainly, I think Cade's got to be, like, number one on the list when it comes to Baseball Canada's wish list for relief pitchers, right? He's going to be their closer, I got to think, right? But, I mean, you know, Baseball Canada is going to have, you know, maybe not a wealth of players, but a lot more players to pick from, right, than they have had in years past. And even if it is guys that are still finding their way, like a Dante Norrie, for example, right, who's a minor leaguer who got drafted not that long ago. Edouard Julien has obviously been in the majors for a while now. He's gone up and down between the majors and the minors, right? I mean, you could probably construct an entire rotation if you really needed to out of Canadian players. And the reason I think it's fascinating too, Jules, is that so you got the 2026 World Baseball Classic. In another 2 years, you will have the 2028 Summer Olympics in Los Angeles.
Right,
now, Major League ballplayers have never participated in the Summer Olympics ever. I do wonder what those conversations look like, because I think I have heard pretty recently guys like Bryce Harper and Aaron Judge be asked about this and say, hey, like, what do you think about the potential, you know, NHL players are going back to the Olympics in Milan next year. What do you think about the Major League ball players playing at the Summer Olympics? And they've said, yeah, we'd love that, right? So I do wonder what those conversations look like, even if they probably won't pick up until probably after next year's World Baseball Classic. But God, I would love that. I would love to see pro baseball players, I should say, play the Olympics.
And listen, as athletes, of course they want that experience, right? I mean, how often do you get to say, or how rare is it to get to say that you played in Olympic Games, especially, you know, the inaugural year of a sport at the Olympics? There's just so much to look forward to in the next few years when it comes to just, you know, nation organized baseball, softball as well. I mean, it needs to be said that it's also going to be an Olympic sport in a few years.
I guess it'll return, I guess, right, to Los Angeles. Yeah,
yeah, that's right. And listen, that's I'm such a fan of that stuff. I'm already looking at
Olympics in general. You mean
Olympics in general? Anything that is nation based, right? I'm looking at Bo, who is going to play for Brazil in the WBC. I don't know. It's just an exciting time. I'll tell you what else is going to be exciting, probably. We'll see if Kevin Gausman can bounce back.
It'll be exciting either way.
Anytime you have a rubber match against a possible wild card opponent, that's going to be good. So Kevin Gausman goes today for the Blue Jays. He is going to face Tanner Bibee. That starts first pitch is at 1:10 p.m. Eastern. And that does it for us. Thanks to Keegan Matheson, to John Morosi, to Cage Smith. Thanks to Sho Ali for coming in today. And to Nick Blackmore, Austin Mackey, and Jennifer Rolnick. I'm Julia Kreutz. I will be back tomorrow with Blake Murphy for Jays Talk Plus. Have a great day, everyone.